recording.
Welcome, Carrie Rogers, to In the Good Company podcast. First guest of 2024. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I feel very honored to be your first guest of 2024, and honestly, just really honored to have gotten to know you over these last couple of months. So thank you for having me.
And vice versa, me too. I'm so excited to have you. And like you said, the last couple months, meeting you and your community you created, it's just amazing. But we'll talk about all of that. But before that, I just want to introduce you. So you are a co-founder of a tribe, which is a healing space and online community for healers. And also you are a yoga instructor, breath work, and sound healing facilitator, and you are a death doula. Mm-hmm. What else, Carrie? What else is there? Just 20 years within the healing modality. What else is on your resume?
Well, actually, my journey into health and wellness started when I became a massage therapist. So That's sort of my original profession in this realm and space. Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. All of that. But I would love to start our conversation where we actually met, through what we met, which is your tribe, which is, like I mentioned, a physical space, amazing, beautiful physical space where people can come in and experience different healing modalities. And also that same space provide a space for healers to conduct, to perform those sessions with clients, which is that's how we met. I was looking for amazing, professional-looking, beautiful space. But the very interesting part is that that was my first thought, and I didn't even think about the community that I definitely was looking for community, but not initially looking at tribe. And what I got was also amazing community of healers and support in business and in self-care, because as healers, we also have to think about that. And running our business and getting stuff done. So what an amazing idea. What a beautiful space here on Belmont in Chicago. But can you tell us, can you share how did you came up with your co-founder with this idea over 12 years ago, how it all started?
Yeah. Thank you for saying such wonderful things about our, sometimes I call it my baby, because Tribe definitely started as a passion project, and Ellen, my co-founder, and we were good friends and colleagues. So we worked together at a massage therapy school, and we had both been instructors, educators at that school, while also pursuing our own work and being massage therapists. And we were there for a very long time. So we both ended up moving into administrative roles in that school. And just over time, we began to be disillusioned by how much we wanted to do there and how much we couldn't do there, right? It was someone else's business. So, and respectfully, she and I would just begin to collaborate, sort of, we always joke, over the filing cabinets. We'd be talking about this idea we had. Ellen had already had just a two-room space in Chicago, and I loved that she had this successful space. She had a vision of wanting to grow that and be a larger scale model. And I had always wanted to create more of a community space that might have been geared toward educational opportunities, continuing education, and a gathering space, right? So, that vision grew into what you know and see as the physical location of Tribe. It is a double storefront space that is a studio and a therapeutic room space. We had, just when we started evolving this idea, this opportunity fell out of the sky.
Always aligned.
As they always do.
Aligned.
A realtor had reached out to Ellen and had said, hey, would you ever want to have a bigger space? This spot opened up. Why don't you come and see it? So it was legitimately the very first space we looked at. And we really only had availability to see what is now the studio. And it had not been anything for multiple years. So it was sort of like the ceiling falling in and just dust everywhere. And we thought, well, this could work, but we don't know if it's enough square footage. About a couple weeks later, and we went to look at a couple different spaces mm-hmm. as well. A couple weeks later, the same guy called and said, hey, the space next door just opened up as well. Do you want to come and see that? You could combine the two. So we went into that space, which is now our therapeutic space. And it was an antiques hoarded space. But it was just a wide open room filled with a ton of stuff. But we could sort of see the vision with all of that out of there. And then it became the space that we could create everything we wanted in. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, I had not had any experience owning a business to the capacity of a physical premises. I ran my own private practice and things like that, but I was using other people's spaces or going into homes to treat people.
Mm-hmm.
So I really did not feel confident as a business owner. I had a lot of fear and apprehension, and it really touched into my soft spots of feeling really exquisitely uncomfortable with the possibility that I could make a lot of mistakes. So I felt like I was really leaning into Ellen a lot, as she knows what to do. She knows what to do, right? And I realized through that process that I was very much disempowering myself. I remember a day where I walked out of the space still feeling a lot of inadequacy, like wanting to be an equal partner, but not feeling like I was bringing the same to the table as she was. But then I kind of looked up and down the street and I thought, you know, there's a million small businesses. None of these people went to business school. A lot of these people are first-time business owners. Anyone can do it. Why can't I?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was just sort of a breakthrough for me to say, yeah, this is a great idea and let's go for it. So the reason we wanted to create this space is that we really valued the community we had with our fellow practitioners. And we realized that a lot of practitioners do not have that opportunity. Most of us, even though we're working one-on-one with people throughout our day, don't have colleagues and coworkers to sort of offload some of the stresses and pressures of the work that we do, or that camaraderie of, you know, just celebrating the successes. And we wanted to create a space like that for practitioners, because we also know that that leads to burnout. When you are just isolated in your work, you grow fatigued. The other reason why we wanted to create it, and this is maybe somewhat selfish, is that we did not want to manage people, meaning we did not want to have employees and run the space as a spa or anything like that.
Additional wellness, healing business.
Exactly. Yeah. And what we realized is that so many people are afraid to go into business or to kind of dip their toe into sort of that entrepreneurial space because of all of the perceived limitations around it, because of, hey, self-included, right? But also there are some tangible limitations for a lot of people who need a physical location to operate their business. That could be financial limitations, difficulty acquiring municipal licenses, all the red tape that holds us back from what could otherwise be a more successful and fulfilling career than just always working for someone else. We also know that, at least in the field of massage therapy, there's a lot of exploitation that occurs where people are sort of worked to the bone and not paid a fair wage for the work that they do. And so we thought, Wouldn't it be amazing that this would be a space where people can start their businesses or grow their businesses with a lot of that fear sort of lifted off, like where we can carry some of the burden for them so that they can at least experience what it's like to own a business, grow a practice, and then eventually, if they outgrow us, amazing, right?
Yeah.
If they then feel resourced or empowered to have their own space, we can help them do that. And we can really feel like we've played an important part of helping someone achieve that. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the event space, it was really just to sort of help people who didn't do one-on-one work, but maybe leaned more into group facilitation to have a space to do that as well. And it's just worked out really beautifully that it just creates this wonderful collection and collective of practitioners. And I will say, we didn't know if other people felt the same way we did, but we kind of trusted that if we feel this way, other people might too. And we just thought, hey, if it's just her and I, you know, seeing clients until people like learn about us, then okay, we'll do it. And what was remarkable is that we had 13 people who we call our founding members who joined our space before our doors ever opened.
That's amazing. And
who were ready to like get started and go and really believed in it. And so it's evolved from there over the last 10 years. Our mission really hasn't changed much other than we've expanded the capacity for people to belong to our community, practitioners specifically, with our online membership too, so that a lot of people don't need physical space, but they do need connection. They do need that sense of collaboration with colleagues and to find a like-souled or like-minded community. And so that's kind of where we're at now. Thanks. Yeah.
Such a great story. And, you know, let me just say, like, such a beautiful space, you know, not only for those who are visiting to get to use the services, but as a practitioner, it's just like, so we were talking about it a few weeks ago, right? That I was like, I was visiting because this is where what you provide met my needs, right? Like, as I am growing my healing practice, I don't feel ready to commit to space, mm-hmm. or I want to, but I want to have this physical space and opportunity to work one-on-one and actual in person with the client. But again, don't want to commit to renting a space and have this commitment of like monthly gigantic rent, etc. And that's amazing. But space itself is beautiful. Wait, and now I always I jump three times around of all the thoughts. You mentioned something important. Oh yeah, because you mentioned the selfishness, you know, so your selfishness, what you call selfishness, I feel like it's just like how you envision your business, right? But it totally meets the need of the other side, who literally is looking for that, right? No full commitment, but also this additional support, which is amazing. I think, you know, as you mentioned, I'm part of it, and having this support of like-minded people, for example, me, and I'm coming from a completely different world, and finding a community that speaks my language, that understands what I'm talking about, that can go deep and talk about deep things that interest me, it's just incredible and priceless. So definitely thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. And it reminds me that we have always strived to be a space where you can just show up exactly as you are. Just like us, you don't have to know every single thing about being a business owner. You don't have to have this hyper confidence that you've got all your stuff figured out. You know, you show up with the gifts that you have, and then you get the support in those areas that just are not your strengths, or that you just don't really know how to navigate those parts. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think it's more endearing for us to be able to show up and say, I should have it all figured out, but I don't. And, you know, there are good days in business ownership and there are bad days in business ownership. And no matter what, you get to show up, even when you're having the bad days. And that there's a space that welcomes that and understands it, really like sees you and says, yeah, I know, I've been there. So I appreciate you saying that, you know, the intention behind community isn't lost on us in that, you know, and that's part of the reason why we didn't want to be employers is that,
yeah,
we really respect and honor individual expression in this work of health and wellness, and that there's room for all of us in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 100%. Okay. So you have your entrepreneurial business co-owner hat, but you're also, like we mentioned, have million healing hats from massage therapist to yoga to healing, sound healing, breath work. Tell me more about that, because that's we again a few weeks ago and just before we started our conversation, we kind of talk about this idea of, you know, allowing yourself to change, to evolve, to explore different things you are interested in, or, you know, maybe some things you are doing now are not calling you that much anymore, but there is interest somewhere else, and allowing yourself. I'm fascinated by this idea, as you know, at 45, but really like 39, I started to completely doing my 180 on things I'm doing in life for work. And I think it's so important to talk about allowing ourselves to do it, you know, not seeing it like starting from zero and just embracing it, because that's what makes life more fulfilling. But tell us about what you're doing now and how you get there and how you combine maybe all these modalities that you learned over the years.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not speaking for any other practitioner, although I know that my story is familiar to many. And that is that a lot of people who enter into the healing arts do so because they are wanting to or seeking to heal something within themselves as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So many of us go into it because we want to help others, but there's also that underlying, even sometimes unconscious, desire to heal oneself as well. And when I entered into the field of massage therapy, I was definitely coming out of one of the lowest points of my life. I was very much lost in who I was and who I wanted to be. And there was something in my spirit that was longing for a purposeful change. Mm-hmm. And I had never gotten a professional massage before. And I was about 28 when I decided to change my life. never gotten a professional massage, but I ran into someone that I had known in sort of like a different time of my life out of nowhere, very randomly. And he said, without even like catching up, just, hey, have you ever thought about being a massage therapist? And it really knocked me back. And stuck with me enough that, and I'll edit that part of the story just for time's sake. But it knocked enough attention into me to explore it and choose it as a path. Mm-hmm. And I did heal aspects of myself that I think needed healing at that time. And I also know that a healing journey really isn't, you never arrive to healed. You are always evolving in that realm of healing. And so it's an ongoing journey. And I think that that's what I learned by doing my craft of massage therapy and of teaching, is that when you begin to experience this mm-hmm. work, it opens up a greater curiosity, a deeper desire to know yourself, a deeper desire to help others. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, you enter into experimenting with a lot of different modalities, receiving those modalities, experiencing them for yourself. And the ones that have had the greatest impact on me have been meditation, movement, right? Mm-hmm. Breath work, mm-hmm. and later, death work. Mm-hmm. But all of them have a and sound healing as well, right? And so by experiencing them and really gaining a lot of benefits from them, it's natural to say, hey, if it's helped me, it might be helpful for others too. Let me experience being a practitioner in this as well.
Yeah.
So always just exploring new modalities or taking on a training. And naturally, it just integrates into the work we're already doing. And so that's why you see there's so many unique practitioners out there, right? We all can practice breathwork, but we might all teach it and facilitate it differently. We mm-hmm. all practice massage therapy, but we facilitate it differently. And all of that is because of the new knowledge that we add into the mix, into that sort of cosmic pool of healing.
So that's so, I don't know what you think, but I think like as now I'm meeting more and more people and clients, and I look at them and sometimes I'm like, oh wow, these are completely different cases, and they sometimes need completely different things, right? So sometimes, for example, for me, it's like heavy on breath work because I see that need of this initial kind of somatic, like a work with body before I go any close to energy, because that needs to be, some level needs to be unblocked, where other person, it's a completely different story. So having all these tools, it's almost like you can customize it to whoever comes to you with whatever issue they are experiencing or block or problem or health problem, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's, you know, I joke around. I say I'm like a one woo person. I'm not fully woo woo. meaning I don't have like all my head, like I'm not just like floating around in the spirit world, but I'm also not like no woo, where everything's got to be evidence-based and researched and double blind, all of that stuff. I'm right in the middle. I love the idea of boots on the ground, like show me tangible results from this. And also, we can't have those without there being mystery, without there being a mystical or magical quality that cannot fully be defined. And so I think that's where we come to that term of healing arts, that mm-hmm. there is no protocol, mm-hmm. but there is a formula. Mm-hmm. And each person creates their formula based on the modalities that they choose to integrate into their work. And then the art of that is how we choose to apply our knowledge to the individual. And it is a knowledge-based approach, but it's also an intuitive, intuitive
knowledge or
approach. Approach, yeah.
For people who are seeking and looking for different healing modalities, that's also for them. Like, what are you drawn to? Like, you know, at one point in my life, I was so heavy in breath work because that's what my body at that point needed, release, that kind of release and that kind of alignment and working with my breath and healing through that. And then I was really heavy on massage because I felt like, you know, my body needed this, you know, push, additional push from outside, and those energies had to be released that way. And then I was heavy in therapy, talk therapy, and now I can't even look at it or like think about it, you know? So I think that that's also a beauty of it, you know, that at different points of our healer journey, we may need or be drawn for some reason, that modality can move us forward in our healing, never-ending healing journey, right?
Absolutely. And I think you're touching on something really important here, which is what I've learned. When I decided to retire my massage therapy license, I definitely went through another bit of an identity crisis. It was the most difficult decision I had to make because I actually loved the work I was doing. Most people don't leave the work that they love to do.
Mm-hmm.
But my body was telling me I had to step away from it and find the next identity. And through that, it allowed me to step back and reflect and say, what is it that I love about all of these different modalities that I practice? Because I also am not a frenetic practitioner. I'm not like throwing in every single thing I have at every single person. It's very much like you said, you pay attention and decide this feels applicable right now. And what I learned is that the work that I love to do mm-hmm. all have a single thread through them. And that is the nervous system response.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that what people were telling me they were getting out of the work they were doing with me was, without them knowing it, explaining their nervous system response mm-hmm. and how it had transformed through the work. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, sometimes like no modality is the thing.
Yeah.
It meets us where we're at. Yeah, it meets us where we're at when we need that. And oftentimes we evolve or our needs change over time, depending on how we have met ourselves within our nervous system. And so that is sort of now kind of how I just really explain any of the work I do, even in my transition from, you know, the primary work of massage therapy into death work and into becoming a death doula. My transition into that work happened similarly to why I entered massage therapy. I had gone through a period of immeasurable loss. So many people that I loved died within a short period of time. And people that were very integral to my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that time where I had lost loved ones and mm-hmm. where was in the state of anticipatory loss of more loved ones that I realized that I have a capacity to mm-hmm. be with death differently than a lot of people I knew. And not in a better way or where, you know, not equalizing that to like, oh, I can handle it better. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that at all. It was more about the relationship and the curiosity I've had around death for a very long time that allowed me to, and historically the work I did as a healing arts practitioner in all of the different modalities that just allow me to regulate differently in high stress, difficult, challenging situations. All of those things called me to the work of death doula work or end of life work. And so I took a training because I also knew that I wanted to be a positive support system to those around me who maybe did not have the same relationship with death, loss, or grief. And so I became a death doula in 2021. Mm-hmm. And right at the start of it, right after my aunt passed away and shortly before the loss of my sister-in-law and my father-in-law. So, and then other losses in between, but those were pivotal losses that were sort of threshold, the before becoming an end-of-life doula and after becoming an end-of-life doula. And even in that training, how it gave me an even richer capacity in a way that I would not have otherwise had, and in a way to reflect upon how I could have shown up differently or better with the losses that had preceded that. And so now I am continuing to evolve what that looks like for me, because end of life doula work or death doula work, it's not regulated. Meaning you don't need to have a license to operate as one. And so it's sort of a wide open space for how we want to play a role at the end of life for others. And it's been really beautiful to experience being in relationship with others around death, dying, and grief.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before we got, before going to further explore this topic, I just want to highlight something that you said about this idea of, you know, you being massage therapist, loving this work, really enjoying it, but your body telling you something different and that it's time for a change. I think it's like an amazing moment that I think many of us can apply to anything that that we do, right? Like sometimes we do things we love, we do things that we really enjoy, but there are other factors. And this idea of listening to your body, listening to your intuition, listening to your gut. And even though that may be something you're establishing, that may be something that, again, you enjoy and love, there is a need of change or change of direction. And then how you navigate it through just looking like, you know, what, like you said, I love that. Like, what do you love about the things you are doing? And how can you find similar things in whatever you decide or that those similar things can help you decide what's next, right? Yeah. I love that story. I think it can be applied to anybody, anywhere who is in that kind of a crossroads situation, and so many lessons there. But let's talk about death. Before talking to you, I was thinking this idea, like why we are so scared of death. And I experienced it once very deeply with my father. And I was thinking this idea of, it's immense pain. It is pain, you know, if you are dying or somebody next to you is, and it's this pain. And we obviously, our body, we are just programmed pain avoidance and pain, you know, protection and fear of pain, right? Also, that's the this amazing change that happened. Not amazing, actually, just drastic change sometimes, or not drastic. But that's such much discomfort, right? Because everything changes, nothing is the same. But what do you think, and then also this idea that like we avoid conversation, avoid the subject because it's so heavy and it's such a part of our life, right? What do you think is so, what else is there that we are just so so scared of it and so avoidant? And we are all going there. We all are. You know, and we all experience it in some capacity. You know, even I was thinking also, you know, about talking to you and this idea of our dog dying 2 years ago. And as awful as it is, it was a really tough experience for me. Like, even personally, it was my first dog, baby dog, obviously part of our family. But on some level, it's awful maybe to say, but I was grateful that my daughters experience it on some level, you know, because that's the part of life. And you know, I don't know if they're too young, too old. It's just a part of life. And they experience it in some not drastic level. And we had conversation about it. And we... you know, so I thought that, you know, as awful as it sounds, that was really a blessing on some level. But what are your thoughts? What, you know, as you even work in that field?
Yeah, I mean, oh gosh, there's so much to say, and this could be a conversation all in itself. What I will say to answer your question of like why we have so much fear around it. And this is respectful that there are many different cultures and many different religions that have varying viewpoints around death and dying. But typically, you know, the culture, at least that we see in the US, I'll say, is that is a culture of avoidance, is a culture of like not talking about it. It's a culture of protecting people from the suffering of it, protecting people from the pain of it. It is just really a back room experience for so many people. And I really do admire you for seeing that there's an opportunity for children to have a mindful level of exposure to death and dying and to learn to navigate grief earlier in life, rather than us trying to somehow protect them from a painful experience. And all of that is, you know, I think from my like meditative practice and my mindfulness practice, in my work, and especially when looking at death and dying in particular, is that there's never any intention on my end that to make anyone wrong for the experience that they have, right? What I look at it from is the perspective of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The things we avoid, when we avoid
mm-hmm.
pain, heartache, despair, grief, we actually create more suffering for ourselves in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
When we do not confront a dying person,
mm-hmm.
when we avoid being around that process of dying, we inevitably create either more suffering for ourselves or more suffering for the dying person.
Mm-hmm.
And so my whole belief system around this is that it's okay that we have fear of dying. Why? Because it's an absolutely unknown phenomenon.
Yeah.
We cannot know until we are actually going through it ourselves what death and dying feels like. And that unknowing is where our fear originates. And because we have all these beliefs that it's going to be painful, it's going to be terrible, it's going to be ugly, it's going to be, and that's through the perspective of one's own death, right?
Yeah.
That we don't want to sit and think about it, contemplate it, plan for it, be with it. Naturally, that's a human instinct of survival.
And who knows, we may also end up in hell. Let's ask that.
Right. So, you know, there's that. And then the idea of the experience we have when we lose a loved one. Pet, human, it doesn't matter. You know, grief and loss is not even always related to a person or an animal dying, a loved one dying. It can be the loss of some type of livelihood, right? Even people who go through a divorce, that's a death of a kind. People who, you know, lose a career or a job, not of their own doing, that is a death of a kind, right? So yes, to your point, death is all around us. It is woven into nature. It is an inevitable experience that we will each meet. Mm-hmm. And the way that we can at least meet that fear is to begin having the conversations about it, to bring it forward, to make it more culturally relevant and integrated, rather than something that we avoid until we are in crisis mode. And that's actually what I see a lot of in my work in terms of people who reach out to me. It isn't often people who are planning ahead. Mm-hmm. It's often family members who are losing a loved one. They're very close to death and they have no idea what to do. And they become desperate to try to do something to help in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say is that that is so common and so frequent because we have not integrated throughout our lifetimes the ability to actually plan our end of life and to have these conversations with loved ones about how they would imagine their end of life being. Because yeah. If we did that, there so much of the mystery would be pulled away.
And fear.
And
you know,
so much of the fear.
Live. Yeah.
And so I think that that kind of answers that question. And I also think that, you know, maybe I'm someone who's always had a curiosity, a fascination with, an awareness of death.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much protected from that as a child. I didn't go to funerals of people I loved because I wasn't given a choice. It just was we're going to this funeral, you won't. And how that could have maybe been and like honoring that, you know, my guardians, my caregivers, my parents thought they were doing the best they could and thought they were doing the right thing to protect me. Mm-hmm. And to your point, right, how can we allow this to be just a part of life, mm-hmm. that we can maybe even become better or stronger for it? And I actually, you know, I think you corrected something that you said about that there's an amazing quality to death or dying. And I actually would agree with you, mm-hmm. that, and this is the other thing, is that we tend to only focus on the hard parts, the ugly parts, the difficult parts, the scary parts. And there's room for us to sort of strip away and see it from a more whole perspective, just like life, mm-hmm. like birth. Yes, it's messy. Yes, it's scary. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's tragic. And when we can be fully present to the experience and really see the whole experience, it is also incredibly touching. Mm-hmm. Deeply beautiful, mm-hmm. wildly amazing, mm-hmm. at the same time, and incredibly loving at the same time as it is difficult, heartbreaking, and challenging. And so to me, we could change the culture by allowing all of those other things to also be true and present in the conversation and experience of losing someone. And that's what end of life work really can be, is helping people to create as much as possible what they would imagine as a good death. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that we will actually have that experience at the end of life, but if we could at least have our wishes known, we take away some of that mystery. We might actually then have beautiful music playing while we're on our deathbed, mm-hmm. have the people we want surrounding us when we take our last breath, mm-hmm. Having had the conversations that might not have ever been spoken until after someone dies, right? Mm-hmm. But I love this idea. There's this new phenomenon of having living funerals, and that is someone who's nearing the end of life to actually have a party, a celebration, a memorial before they actually die, so that they can hear how people feel about them while they're still alive.
I'm not sure about this one. This is like for me, like,
I'll say that it's not sweeping the nation. So, but
I think like planning, you know, planning and having your plan executed, but like being there, that's like a different. I love this idea of celebration of life, you know, like, you know, in my culture in Poland, it's embracing the sadness, a part of it, you know, it's like a last walk to the grave, and I love this idea of like the celebration of life, the focusing on all the beautiful moments we had together, right? Even the moment is tough, but I think that would help going even through this moment, and why not to focus on life celebration, right? Even if we, yeah, but that's what I'm not sure about, but I'm not judgmental, you know, whatever blow your horn.
Well, but here's the thing, right, Anna, is that when you learn all of the ways that you can die,
yeah,
when you explore those, you begin to know what is and is not for you, and you can have a say rather than having other people decide for you, right? And in doing that, I think it's exposure. I think the more we can expose ourselves to these experiences, the more we are better able to regulate ourselves when we get there, right? And to just sort of learn more about ourselves and what others want. I've had some of the most beautiful conversations with people I love around this concept of death and dying. Mm-hmm. Not as a tearful, heavy, sad conversation, but one that's actually joyful, mm-hmm. Surprising, wildly surprising, mm-hmm. And deeply connecting. Mm-hmm. And if I had not had the willingness to experience or explore that, to even ask, these are things I still wouldn't know. And so to me, and you know, there's a lot of resources out there too, I would say, about how do we start to have these conversations with people, because it can be really strange to, you know, hey, let's talk about death, right? I mean, I'm all ears. I'm always like, absolutely, let's talk about that. But most people are like, oh, I can't think about it. And some people are even superstitious that talking about it can make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so to me, it's also none of this should feel forced. I think that there's a really beautiful way where we can just slowly begin to lessen some of the discomfort around the unknown around death and dying. Mm-hmm.
I see a subject in high school, you know, end of the high school, like death planning. Yes. You know, I think we learn so many stuff in school that are not fully usable versus this practical, you know, like even like budgeting or career planning or career transitioning or career choice, whatever. And then having something like, hey, like, why not to plan it and think about it, like what it encompasses for yourself, for others, and how amazing that would be, you know?
Absolutely.
To have those conversations at a young age that maybe you're not that scared of it, or, you know, even more paralyzed by thought of it because you are getting closer there, you know?
Yeah.
So interesting.
Yeah. And I think at least in my own work, I realize, you know, I've always been drawn to education, right? Yeah. The teaching and the facilitating. So a lot of the work I do is to help people experience and explore death before it's a crisis. Like, death doesn't always have to be a crisis. And that does not include sudden, unexpected, or violent loss, right? But for me, I'm thrilled when someone reaches out to me to give a talk to people just about what being an end-of-life doula looks like, because it's just, again, the more that we can help people understand, spending a little time thinking about it, mm-hmm. is safe, it is valuable, and it can be deeply meaningful. And my personal philosophy is that the greater relationship we have with contemplating our own death, mm-hmm. the more meaningful how we live day to day can be. Mm-hmm. We tend to live much more conscientiously. We make choices that are leaned into our values. We consider how we're spending our time when we accept that our time in these physical bodies is finite, that we will not live forever. And so knowing that, it might make you sad for a moment, certainly, but it can also give you the opportunity to make the career change, to have the relationships you want, to do the things in your life that are exciting and meaningful to you, because you know, I'm not going to be able to do this forever.
Enrich the life you have.
Yes.
Because you have this awareness of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Such an interesting subject. And then the other tricky, you know, in the context of death is also grief. I feel like you know, this is something that I am dealing with still, you know, after death of my father, and it's 30 years. And it's such a, I was thinking about it, like, now this grief is like my BFF. And, you know, and it just shows up in such a weird moment. Like the other day, I was looking at this grandparent playing with the kids, and I just was so, you know, I got throat closing, heart closing, and just tears. And that was grief. And I was like, okay, that's really sad. That's really painful. But I learned not to push it away. I learned to, you know, be with it for a second. But it's, I was thinking about it, it's like 30 years and it still shows up. You know, what that part, I think it's also, it is difficult. And it's not difficult, but it's just this discomfort that it gives you. And it's, you know, the deeper the love, I think that the deeper the grief.
Absolutely.
And it can be such a long process. Like I literally call grief my BFF now with the context of my father, because it really just shows up, you know, less frequently, but still is here. So that's also probably something that we are avoiding and scared of, because it's not like a, you know, one-time process. It can be really long and really painful at some point, you know?
Yeah. You know, this is like a full circle to our conversation, because it's, to me, grieving is no different than healing. I think they're one and the same. It's a lifetime journey. There's mm-hmm. never going to be a point where you have grieved yourself out of it. You can be knocked over by it 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And that can feel like an oppressive life sentence. However, it's just like you said, it's sort of this unexpressed love that we have nowhere to channel it to.
Yeah.
And I think, right. And I think that that's why, you know, I think this is where people can be made to feel wrong, or where we don't have enough space to actually share and express how grief is such a journey, because we're told we should be over it by now, or we should be done by now, right?
This is what I experienced within my family. You know, I felt like those are the people who should understand me the most. And I felt like I was told I'm living in the past. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm living in the past? No, I am living in the present, but my heart is broken forever, you know? And I was just so, I just recently discovered how wrong it was, you know? And for myself even, that stopped my process of dealing with everything, because some people are uncomfortable with talking about things. Some people don't want to bring the heavy subject, even if they are brought up in the context, oh, remember when we did this or this? And it's just like, and this is such a great point, because I, like, literally that happened to me, like shaming my grief was something that I experienced. And I was like, oh my gosh. It's so, it's always will be with me. And it's not me living in the past. I'm like literally in the present moment, the mostly I could be, but there is this scar within me that always will be there. And I love it on some level, you know? Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. And I'm, you know, my heart goes out to you for that experience. My heart goes out to those people as well. We are masters at projecting. Right. And so, you know, you should handle this the way I handle it. And there is no right way to grieve. And there is no right way to heal. Mm-hmm. It is such a deeply personal experience. And the more we can hold grace and compassion for how anyone experiences that, you know, the more we can, I think, allow it into the space. And you know, that a person who does not have a tolerance for someone else's grief, mm-hmm. To me, that says that they don't have a tolerance in themselves for the grief they experience. And so for them, their mode of survival is to
shut it down.
Yeah. And so that's what you should be doing as well. And so, you know, and again, that's not wrong for that person to do that if that's what that person needs to continue on. And yet we also have to be aware of how much we can project that our tolerance or intolerance onto others. The same thing, I wouldn't force a conversation on death with someone else because I think they should be able to talk about it. You know, you can sort of, how can I co-regulate that experience and pay close attention to someone just not having the capacity for it, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I will say though that when it comes to grief, there's so much more work that we can do to understand it. And even in like what's been researched around it as like the stages of grief isn't necessarily accurate or true. It's helpful in some capacities, but not in others, is that we can just give ourselves a space of allowing for those mm-hmm. moments to arise. And that understanding that everything is temporary and that nothing is an end point, even death, right? Mm-hmm. So you're honoring the life of your father by imagining him a grandfather to your children. Mm-hmm. And him being physically gone does mm-hmm. not mean that he's not the grandfather to your children, right? And so naturally that's going to pull at your heartstrings to consider that what that would look like as a lived experience. Mm-hmm. And that we can then allow that grief to move through us in a way that allows us to channel our love, right? That allows us to presence this person in our life and keep them alive with us, right? So I really appreciate you sharing that story.
Yeah, and it's just such an interesting, I love how you will call the grief the unexpressed love, because it really, this is what it is, you know, like unexpressed love and life. Yeah. Tool, I think, because this is that like we are grieving and having pain over what could be, life could be, right? Unexpressed life, because it's cut on some level. But to the point of you like talking about like how, for example, my father lives in our lives, it's so funny because I noticed we do the small things, like now when it's winter, I remember when I was a kid, my dad was like pulling my tights and like hanging me on these tights, and you know, like I was like hanging, and now with my daughters I do the same thing, and we say Dziadek Krzysio, Dziadek Krzysio, and oh, they always come to me and they say like, can you do Dziadek Krzysio on me? Like, such a, like I was thinking like the other day we're doing this with my daughter, and it's just such a small way that that I am dealing with my grief, and that at the same time my father, my dad is living with my daughters now, and he's still here, like you said, you know, in some capacity he's still living through those like weirdest experiences we do.
Well, that's the thing too, right? It's like but that I think is where we have the opportunities to find the sweetness in the grief, right? That we can have this laughter and bit of lightness around something that feels so silly, but that threads their lives into today, into right now. And what a touching visualization of like your children asking you to do that.
Yeah. It's
so really beautiful.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe we should switch to the more lively subject. It's not that discomfortable. No, but seriously, I want to ask you, from going back to healing modalities, as you try different things, like what is your thing you love right now, or your drone? Mm. Like we talked about, like a different moments in our life or our own healing journeys that are never ending. We are drawn to different things, or maybe you discovered something that, you know, that's I am that type that I'm like, oh my God, this is like life changing at this moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to be careful that I'm not chasing like the next shiny object.
But what are you enjoying when it comes to like those healing practices, even like self-healing?
Yeah. This is like a very new concept for me. I'm really loving this idea of rest, which is not really a modality, but a really difficult practice for me, which is kind of the beauty of non-doing.
Yeah.
Of like letting yourself just be. I think that's something I discovered in that little identity crisis I went through when I let go of my role as a massage therapist and got really ungrounded of like, who am I now? of like, wow, I really leaned so much into who I was in this identity. And like, I'm still me. Nothing's really changed other than that work that I do. And like realizing how much I push myself to always be doing something, always feeling like there's more I have to get to. And like just letting my practice, my self-care practice, be to like rest and to say, hey, I did as much as I could today, and now I'm closing everything down. But on the side of modalities, what I have really loved myself is some of the work I do in my one-on-one sessions with others. Every time I have a session at some point in the period of time when I see clients, I'm on my mat, on my bed, receiving what I give to others. So that is, I've been using a lot of technology for nervous system recovery. So I work with people in vibroacoustic therapy and far infrared heat. So I use a bed that's embedded with speakers and subwoofers, and I use soundtracks that basically create a vibroacoustic resonance within the body that help to sort of attune your own frequency to specific frequencies that we know are in nature and that I would say is sort of like our true frequency, the capacity we have to be sort of in these states, not even elevated or heightened states, but just in a state. And it's been so powerful. The reason I integrated it into my own practice is because I laid on one of these mats for 20 minutes. Because I was like, what is this? And they said, oh, lay on it for 20 minutes. I walked out of there. I felt like I was intoxicated. I had to pull my car over. I went into a laughing fit. I was like, what on earth?
Oh my God, Carrie, I have to try it.
What on earth was that? Yes. And then it was, I have to have one of those, right? So, and then I integrated it with a different mat that I have, which is an amethyst biomat, which is, sounds woo-woo, but it's actually, it's a grade 4 medical device, approved medical device by the FDA because of the implications it has on your circulatory system.
I'm sitting on one right now.
Oh, yeah, right? I mean, the experience I've had with laying on them and other people that are not in the world of health and wellness, the experiences they've had on laying on that, I just thought it'd be so cool to integrate these two. I don't know anyone else who's doing that. So, hey, why not? And so when I am doing that work, and it takes a little bit to set all that equipment up. So before I knock it down, I treat myself as well to those technologies. And I really love it. It can be a facilitated experience, but it can also be one in which you are really just resourcing your own ability to regulate, to relax, to connect, and to feel sort of this greater sense of consciousness. So that's been kind of my jam these days.
I want to try this new shiny thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so incredible. You know, I always like to say that, you know, our bodies are such a genius machines that, you know, it's just incredible what can awaken us, heal us, how we can heal ourselves. I'm just fascinated every day by my own body and its capabilities working with people, by everybody else. I feel like we are just touching on certain things when it comes to holistic and alternative medicine, and you know, not discriminating and not diminishing importance of Western medicine ever, never. I think it's always science and woo-woo, like you mentioned. But I think it's just incredible potential into tapping into like the potential of healing of our own body, you know, with those additional maybe technological yeah. devices, frequencies or whatnot. Oh, that's amazing.
It's so fun.
I'll definitely link to this offering below. Is there anything else you are offering? I know you you just had a sound bath that unfortunately I had to miss due to some scheduling issues, but is there anything else coming up?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I do one-on-one sessions currently weekly. I offer those. The sound experience, the sound healing journey we call Sacred, is a collaboration I do with another practitioner. We offer those monthly. So the next one will come up. They're typically on the third Tuesdays of the month, and that's at our studio at Tribe. And then I have a new forum starting next week. This is a 4-week Zoom program that is called the Inspired Living Forum on Death and Dying. And mm-hmm. it is a 4-week journey of deepening your connection, exploring your own relationship with death and dying mm-hmm. Through the lens of meditation, through discussion. And I'm starting that next Tuesday again. So I do have some spots open for that. And I've run that program a couple times now, and it's been, wow, just such a beautiful experience. So, so I would also say for people who have not explored any of these types of modalities, I take a very kind and slow approach to all of it. Everything I do is very gentle and mindful, and it might push you a little bit. It definitely can find your edges of comfort, but there's nothing forced and there's nothing aggressive or assertive about any of these. So if you're curious but a little intimidated or don't know what to expect, I would say that that you can contact me and ask more questions, and this is a great way to begin an exploration into these modalities. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Kari, so much for this conversation and for what you're doing and for this beautiful community that you and Ellen created. It's really a gift that keeps giving, and I'm so happy to be a part of it. And like I said, I will link everything we talked about, your offerings, below. And I like to say love and light until the next time. Thank you, Kari.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate that we always have meaningful conversations.
I know, right? Always.
Thank you so much. Okay.